Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 966.GE2803, certificate number 2037. The Population Bomb.
Because you murdered half the planet.
A small price to pay for salvation.
You're insane.
Ken, you know, probably as well as anyone, how concerned I am about climate change.
It's kind of your main thing. Like, do you have a thing in front of your house that says, in this house, climate change is real? Because maybe, well, you should get one of those and then we would know how sincere your liberal bona fides are.
In my house, the climate changes all the time because...
Because you leave the doors open?
Yeah, that, and it depends on what I eat and whether I remember to turn the furnace. Oh my, dang it. I forgot to turn the furnace off when I left.
You don't love the climate.
Ugh. You know,
get a smart thermostat.
Because I have an old house, I have a bad furnace, and I asked the furnace man what I should do, and he said, I was like, what should I do about this furnace? He was like, get a different furnace. And I was like, yeah, thanks. I know that already. But, you know, I want to get one of these heat pump furnaces.
Pretty cool.
It is cool.
Because, you know, you get AC for nothing.
Yeah, but I'm still on the fence about it. But it's coming because I believe that climate change is real, and I'm very concerned about it. In fact, here on the Omnibus program, I would say that we, as a podcast, as an enterprise, we believe that climate change is real.
It does seem like you're getting ahead of something, but yes, we do.
Don't you think? I mean, we both do, and this is a wholly owned a subsidiary of Omnibus Corp.
I guess well into adulthood, I was like, yeah, that is a real tough problem for rising generations. And in my 40s, suddenly you realize the weather was not what it was. You know, it was no longer just climate scientists modeling it. You could tell as a resident of Seattle or a visitor to different parts of the country that climate is not just going to change, but it's like we're dealing with it already.
We saw it in Alaska a lot earlier.
Oh, yeah. Like the first things that happened were glaciers melting, right?
Glaciers melting. It stopped snowing in winter. The permafrost started melting, releasing tons and tons of methane gas into the atmosphere. The fear then was that it would be there'd be a tipping point where you could no longer, even if it started to freeze again, it was something had happened and there was too much methane being released and there was no way to turn back the tide. You hear about that maybe a little bit less now that other things are
worse.
That there are more hurricanes or whatever.
It used to be that problems wouldn't stop making the news because we solved them. Now it's just the other problems got more urgent, so you don't hear about the slower time bombs.
We're recording this show right after the big hurricane hit and basically washed out Asheville, North Carolina, as well as 100 other towns.
Yeah, places that people thought of as climate refuges because they were so far from the coast.
Yeah, up in the mountains, nice, relaxed, cool in summers, warm in winters.
The Seattle of North Carolina.
And yet, whoosh. However.
But.
I also have long felt that there's a tendency in human beings to try to effect change through kind of alarmist hyperbole.
I mean, neither of us like the climate nihilism that you get into when you think that it's already too late to help.
Yes. And the climate catastrophization, which I think of as a kind of determinism or fatalism, where it's not only too late to help, but there is no future.
It's inevitable
yeah.
that things just always get worse.
Yeah. Those things I feel like are reoccurring themes in human history. They're in every generation. And I don't mean every era. I mean literally every generation.
Throws a hero up the pop charts?
That's right.
But also every generation thinks they're uniquely doomed.
Every generation thinks they're uniquely doomed, and there's always a very plausible explanation for why they're doomed. And it did not change from the era of great superstition, when the thing that was coming was the second coming, or the devil, or whatever it was. The trees, the Ents were going to march on Isengard. You know, that only really affected the Uruk-hai of Isengard.
Yeah, I mean, climate change, they got flooded.
They
right?
did.
Remember the Ents opened the gates or dammed the gates or something?
That's right.
I don't know.
No, they opened they undid the dam.
They did?
Which we're also doing in the Northwest. We're undoing the dams.
The salmon must have been so happy. Like, Saruman was bummed, but the salmon were like, woo!
To go in and put out the fires inside of, yeah.
I just remember, like, the first time, I think in my 20s, I learned a lot of historians think there's pretty good evidence that there was like a lot of apocalyptic doomsaying in the year 1000, you know, because, yeah. Well, this is clearly the end of history. It's the year 1000. I can't imagine there being a 4-digit year.
I know.
And that's kind of eye-opening for me. Like, that was a moment where I thought, maybe we Reagan-era kids are not uniquely nuclearly doomed if like monks in 1000 AD were also sure, you know?
What's been interesting is that as we, in the last 300 years, transitioned out of the, you know, 10,000 year reign of kind of modern superstition, seeing the world as...
What's a modern superstition?
Well,
like, name your car?
If you think about the Greek and Roman gods, there is modernism in them, right? There's mechanics, right? I mean,
they're like, we're the smart ones. We're not.
Yeah. We see
we're
the signs.
We're trying to figure things out.
But things, you know, it's not just like a vengeful earth exclusively cruel gods. They're rational gods.
We do have a lightning god, but also yeah. we're trying to figure out which animals are related.
Yeah. And they live in a house and their actions are explainable. But as we transitioned since the Enlightenment to a world of science and reason, ostensibly, the kind of generational apocalypse trend has not really changed, and in many ways kind of accelerated, because scientists often contribute to the kind of alarmism because they have evidence to support various claims that the end times are nigh. And a lot of that evidence depends on something that's very hard, well, impossible to predict, which is that things...
Which trends continue and which things don't, you know?
Almost all evidence can support an apocalyptic conclusion if nothing else changes. If everything stays the same except for this one thing, like there are goldfish breeders all around the world, and if they keep breeding goldfish at this level and nothing else changes, then we'll all drown in goldfish.
Well, goldfish prices will certainly decline. Like, dump your goldfish years.
That's the first thing that will happen, and that will collapse the world economy. But in the Enlightenment in particular, in the mid-18th century, it was kind of a contrasting period of utopian hopefulness. And you see every generation kind of also has a period of utopian hopefulness. We think of, for instance,
the Obama getting elected.
Yeah, Obama getting elected, right. Or the post-war feeling that we had, or the post-World War One feeling that we had fought the final war.
Finally, war is over.
That's right. Whew,
cross that one off the list.
But you know, the Enlightenment was a period where a combination of science and good government and philosophy and the new world and developments, you know, the steam engine, I mean, all of these things seemed to presage a new epoch in human history where we could conceivably achieve a vision of utopia that actually wasn't that different from the vision of utopia we might even have now if we let ourselves dream, in spite of thinking of that time as being a irredeemable era of slavers. Most of the thinkers were trying to imagine a world of equality and freedom for all.
Yeah, the same kind of place we would like to live.
Right. And they had much more progressive values and ideas than maybe contemporary critics would give them credit for. And it was, I mean, in the United States, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, all of these things seemed to be trending toward, in some ways, an accomplishment of those Enlightenment ideals. And that's why we still talk about that time. And that's why we still, I mean, there are people that are wistful for a time not that long ago when the Enlightenment still kind of governed what would have been intellectual history.
So the scientific consensus, which right. Maybe we don't see as much in our era as we thought we would.
But there were bummers even then.
There were bummers even then. That should be your history textbook, your Howard Zinn book.
It is. It's basically, yeah, my people's history of the United States. It's just the bummers, just the dudes that were bummers. But there was an essayist and Episcopalian cleric, and you know, this was the era of the elite scientist. You know, the gentleman scientist.
Yeah,
that we've discussed quite a bit on the
gifted
show.
Gifted amateur, natural philosopher.
But a man by the name of Thomas Malthus, who was, despite his Scandinavian/German name, was an Englishman.
Well, you didn't have to say it Malthus like you did. Thomas.
Malthus. He wrote a very influential essay on called The Essay on the Principle of Population. And his premise was that although we were, and by we, I mean the West and the product of the scientific Enlightenment.
Yeah, include yourself. Why not?
Yeah, that's me, basically. Although we were increasing well-being, increasing the standard of living kind of across the Western nations and in the instances where colonialism was already expanding to encompass the world, seemed that those advances in standard of living, although maybe not immediately applied or equally applied.
But in the eyes of the time, yeah.
Yeah, and would have been possible within this sphere because one of the premises of colonialism was that we were going to uplift.
And improve them.
Yeah, uplift all
if
of
only
the
only they were a little more Christian savages. And had the steam engine.
Exactly. But what Malthus sort of proposed was that when well-being increased, people would naturally respond to that greater abundance by having more children because now they can afford it.
That's plausible.
It's very plausible.
You probably have unprotected sex more when you're in a good mood in general.
Well, yeah. And I mean, why do you only have 14 kids when you could have 24 kids? Well, it's because you can't afford to have 14 kids.
And today I think we know, and you'll probably get into this, we know there's some evidence for this. Would Malthus have known this, that like there's a history of populations growing in good times, or is he just going on vibes?
I think there is, again, science and research and observation would have given him plenty of statistical evidence to refer to. I mean, he's not just pulling this down out of, he's not just a negative Nelly who's responding to all the Lockean happy news.
But we know now that in a situation where resources grow, organisms have more offspring.
Well, in fact, as we'll see, that is not necessarily the inevitable conclusion. I know, shocking as it may be. But at the time, that was a very persuasive argument. And what he prognosticated was that as living standards increased, so too would population in a kind of cycle, a gyre, where a greater population would then have the technology and the labor resources to grow standard of living, more crops, more industry, thereby giving, you know, room and resources to grow the population until it became a Malthusian trap.
Did he name it after himself? He was like, I call this the Malthusian trap.
He didn't, although he was very influential in his time. He influenced Darwin. He influenced John Maynard Keynes. A lot of people sort of took this this theory and expanded upon it, or used it as a kind of model of thinking about economics, of thinking about
I feel like it
development.
Is, at its most basic level, he's making a mathematical argument, right? This is how I learned about Malthus, that, you know, he thinks that things like food production are always going to grow arithmetically.
Right.
Whereas population, we know, has the potential to double. That's exponential growth.
Right.
Two mice become four, become eight, 16, 32. So even if food production keeps increasing, there's no way to stay ahead of the doubling.
That's right. And because it was, because, you know, he was making these observations and suggesting these, this sort of potential Malthusian catastrophe, although he never said that, but that was kind of the logical conclusion for some people. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was also...
So he's not writing a warning tract, really? That was not his vibe?
He's observing, and he doesn't have a kind of... He's not laying out the inevitable consequences of what he's describing. Mm-hmm. He's just laying out, as you say, the equation for it. What he doesn't anticipate is the Industrial Revolution, which happens, you know, within a couple of decades of his essay on the principle of population.
It would have been very hard for him to predict the Industrial Revolution.
Well, no one expects the Spanish Inquisition, and that's part of the show we're doing today. He couldn't have predicted the Industrial Revolution, although maybe. I mean, if you can predict, the Malthusian catastrophe, somebody over here is looking at the steam engine and thinking, oh, we're going to be able to make a lot more cotton garments, and we're going to potentially be able to thresh a lot more wheat.
I don't feel like a wise person, but like in middle age, you can't help but look back and see all the just kind of weird pivots of history that were totally unexpected, where you assumed, well, nothing can change this trend, you know?
Yeah.
Like, communism is not going to fall kind of in an 18-month period.
Right.
Or, you know, people will always prefer the suburbs to the cities. That seems generational. And then when that reversed, well, urban cores will never be in trouble again unless there's a global pandemic that lasts years, you know? Like, you don't anticipate any of these epical paradigm shifts.
No, it's really hard to, impossible to. And I think the best...
You don't,
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to say you don't want to be overconfident about any outcome, like a gloomy one or a sunny one, you know?
Yeah, my only argument, and I try to make it all the time, against alarmism is not any picture of a rosy future, but just a reminder that you cannot, that nothing is foreordained.
Nothing is inevitable.
And that kind of causal determinism, which just suggests that, well, we have the clear picture. We know how people are. We know what the resources are. We know what the systems are. And so, ergo, you cannot conclude otherwise. And that is a very human tendency, and it feels very true to us all.
Yep.
Because in our moment, we think we're always at the end of history. It's just it's,
you are, you yeah, know. History this, always ends right now.
This is it, and here it is again.
But I was wrong a second ago. Nope. Now it's ending now. Yeah. Now it's now.
And so he was, I think, then parodied by people like Dickens, who thought he was a drag. And Dickens actually based Ebenezer Scrooge on Malthus.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Partly. I've heard other models, but I guess partly on Malthus, huh?
Yeah, just, I mean, and partly on the...
I guess Scrooge does say these kinds of things about social trends and...
And some of...
decrease the... Doesn't he say, like, you would bet that if you are going to die, then you had better do it and decrease the surplus population.
Exactly.
I guess the idea that there would be a surplus population had not existed before Malthus.
Well, and what happened as a result of Malthus was, because this was also happening in an era where... social dynamics were, there were a lot of theories about how we were going to manage not just overpopulation, but overpopulation in cities, a great expansion in who the working poor were, how do we get food to all these people. And this was an era where social engineering was a very popular sort of dining room discussion topic for members of the intelligentsia.
And that's what you want, those people talking about sterilization and stuff.
And, you know, eugenics began as a progressive social theory.
How do we fix the doom that awaits us?
That's right. And the idea that that Ebenezer Scrooge had that, like, well, you know, if the poor die in some mass amount, it will only clear space for there to be more good people, and we will develop this utopian society by virtue of just the poor not being able to cut it.
Dickens might have heard smart people saying that at dinner.
Yeah, and this was social Darwinism. You know, they weren't necessarily thinking, well, let's murder them in the streets, but just that the best will survive. But Malthus kind of fell out of fashion then at the end of the 19th century, because that was a period, despite all the gloom and doom, where, but despite the gloom and doom that accompanies any era, that was another era where tremendous strides were being made in technology and industry, and it seemed like, well, wait a minute, now that we have the electric light and the steam-powered thresher, like all of the world's problems are solved. We can cross the Atlantic Ocean in only 11 days now.
That's what I thought about the iPhone. I identify.
See, that's how it do. But by the period after the war, and again, we're talking about the mid-century, my favorite time because it's when I was born, and although I am at the end of history, I think that the beginning of history was 1948.
It was when you were born.
20 years before I was born, the day they started the United Nations, history began. There was a new awareness, I think, after the war of, well, the seeds of environmentalism. And this is before Silent Spring. This is before the sort of 60s rise in environmentalism. And a lot of it was sort of a combination of fear of overpopulation and famine.
Had real famines were happening to spark this, right? Maybe China? I'm trying to think where the big headline famines were.
This is right before, you know, the big famines in China. But of course, during the war,
yeah, I guess everybody was thinking of hunger. And
but it was really a recognition that the population of the world was expanding, on this exponential timeline, right? In 1900, the population of the world was 1.6 billion. And by 1927, it was 2 billion. After the war, it was 2.5 billion, which by that point seemed like an unsupportable number of people. You had seen a 1 billion, like almost a doubling of the world population in just the space of 50
years. It used to take so long to double, and also there was less awareness of it. You know, agencies were not putting the world population in headlines. It must have seemed very alarming that suddenly we just went from 2 to 3 billion. But I just remember it being 2 billion.
Right.
That this has never happened before. This is the end of history.
And it was during a period where there had been a lot of land reform in that 50 years throughout the Soviet Union, throughout, in a lot of the Western world. It was the end of serfdom, I guess, 100 years prior, but big estates were being broken up. There was a lot of land reform, but there hadn't yet been a lot of increase in land productivity. So big farms were being broken up into small farms, but then those small farms were basically producing a subsistence living, but not enough to feed the doubling population. And there were a lot of crackpot theories, too, about agriculture during that period. We've discussed a few of them on the show. There's a famous Russian...
We talked about all the five-year plan stuff.
Yeah, the five-year plan stuff that ended up being, you know, like there's no way that any of that would have worked. And, of course, the great famines then that followed in China, their great leaps forward that by some estimates resulted in 60 million dead.
Do you think people know about the Stalinist famines in the Ukraine? Like, did that make Western news?
Yeah, it did.
So people
knew. The Holodomor.
Yeah, so people knew that. People had the vague idea that in crowded parts of the world, people were dying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Like by the millions.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait, and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
There were two very influential books, one written, and both came out in 1948, one written by Fairfield Osborne called Our Plundered Planet, and another by William Vogt called The Road to Survival. And both of them were, you know, bestsellers, and they both portrayed a kind of inevitable future where overpopulation would produce famine. If people grew at this rate, if the population of the world grew at this rate, and agricultural yields grew at the rate they're currently growing, there's no other conclusion than that there would be more people than the world could feed. And that would result in mass starvation. And because that mass starvation was predictable in the sense that we were noticing it now, here in the United States. And this was also a period when the U.S. was kind of a global breadbasket and was sending food aid to many places in distress. Some of the suggestion of the books was that the United States had a responsibility in this case. This was part of the American century when we were going to need to determine where to come to the rescue and what to do in that case. There was another sort of essay or pamphlet that came out in 1954 called "The Population Bomb is Everybody's Baby."
You're responsible.
Yeah, that sort of laid this out.
Multiplying middle America.
Well, you're responsible multiplying middle America, but the global famines that will produce hundreds of millions of dead are also kind of on our doorstep.
There was, I'm just thinking about like science fiction at the time started to have this kind of overcrowded future. Like before The Population Bomb even came out, there's the Soylent Green book, like Harry Harrison's Make Room is about a crowded planet with too many people for food. What do? Well, you start feeding people to each other. And
right.
There's a Star Trek episode around this time. The smart progressives that were writing science fiction were really thought of this as the looming enemy.
Well, one of the justifications of space exploration was to find
a
new home for the world as we made our own world uninhabitable. And the connection between exponential population growth and despoilment of the environment was very much made then by these thinkers. It wasn't just that we were growing at unsupportable numbers and doing so because we had been raising the standard of living to the point that people were able to reproduce. I mean, this was the unintended consequence of our good
success.
Works up till now.
Yeah.
But we were also then despoiling the world in order to accomplish this in ways that, and this is part of what we still say, in ways that depleted the natural environment where that depletion was permanent. We could never replace the copper we'd taken out of the ground. We could never replace the rainforest.
And it definitely reframes, we've done so well, our population is booming as a warning sign. You know, we've done so well that other populations might suffer. You know, this might not be sustainable.
Well, we've done so well that other populations might suffer, but also other populations are going to want to duplicate our success.
Mm.
And so that's going to expedite the growth and then the resultant fall. And within this...
I guess I meant other populations of other species.
Other species.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I'll like, see what for you the mean. First time, it's like, yay, we did it. Yay, humanity. Now it's like, ooh, I know I'm team humanity, but are we doing too well? Because
right.
We want there to be... Because we also want there to be forests and buffalo.
Yeah, all the owls are dying.
Yeah.
There was in the conversation during this period also an awareness of... Because this was an era where colonialism was under tremendous scrutiny... And many former colonies were being liberated from from the yoke of colonialism, and there was a very real sense that if Americans were conscious of a population explosion being a threat to the world, we couldn't just impose that knowledge on countries like India specifically. Egypt, countries in Africa, because that was intrinsically racist. We couldn't try to say to the Indians, you're growing too fast, you have to subject yourselves to sterilization and birth control.
Especially if the implication is like, it's a bigger problem with you.
Exactly. And so within this movement in the United States, there was a very strong feeling that this needed to start at home.
Yeah.
We needed to restrict our own demographic growth in order to be an example to the world, so that then we could export this this new theory or new practice around the globe as part of a we're all on this big blue marble together, and we need to work. This is very akin to the current sort of thinking around climate change.
And the situation with China, like, hey, you guys can't fire up all these power plants. Okay, I know we had thousands of worse ones, but...
Right. But look, England just closed down its last coal-burning plant just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, here we go. We're on the path.
And new American nuclear online for the first time in decades.
Yeah.
Two new plants have been approved.
Well, in 1967, and by this point, this is right around when I was born, the population of the world was now 3.5 billion. A book by William and Paul Paddock, two brothers, called Famine 1975! Exclamation point.
And what year is this again?
This is 1967.
So it's a shockingly proximate year in the title.
Just right up, just not very far at all.
You can't be like, this is my kid's problem. No, you're going to be hungry in 8 years.
Famine 1975, America's decision, who will survive? And the suggestion by William and Paul Paddock was that the population bomb had already crossed a threshold where there was no turning back.
This is familiar today. Too late. Tipping point's already tipped.
Tipping point is tipped. And they said, as hard as this is, as gross as this is to say, we cannot save everyone.
Oh, they jump right to that.
And this is something we haven't yet seen really in the climate change conversation. The idea that because we do see it in the sense that there's a lot of kind of cynicism around the rich people buying houses in New Zealand, that the rich will survive the climate change because...
But Bangladesh.
Yeah, exactly.
I think there is some of that unspoken, you know. Okay, in the temperate zones, we can flee to Canada. Obviously, there's going to be a ton of instability in the tropics, and maybe we can ride it out.
But it's not... There's a lot of kind of cynical fatalism around it. But the Paddocks were part of this era of where technology and America and all this kind of determinism was happening at a time when America still felt kind of paternalistic about the world, and that it was still acceptable in the West for even liberal thinkers to say,
"Here's what's best."
Yeah, here's what's best. And the Paddocks divided the world into a kind of triage, what they described as triage, where they looked at the nations of the world kind of as they came into the emergency room, and they said, we need to make some hard choices.
And they decided who gets saved.
They said there are three kinds of nations. There are the savable nations who, with aid from the United States, breadbasket of the world, we can feed those people with our exports, and they can be part of the sort of global population that survives the great famines to come. There are the walking wounded nations who, although we can fund them and keep some portion of their population healthy and alive, we cannot do that for everyone in those places. And then there's a third category of nation, which are hopeless. And any amount of aid and food and intervention that we could stage at this point.
It's just good money after bad. It's just lost.
You're just pouring that food into the...
Down the drain.
Down the drain.
Better they starve now. And like everybody else, I'm waiting to hear which nations are which.
India is hopeless in this scenario. Because at the time, the population of India was growing, although, you know, then it was only in the small hundreds of millions, but their agriculture was not growing at a comparable rate. And in 1960, the percentage of the population in India that was suffering from malnutrition was something in the high 80s.
So it was already a problem. It's not like he's predicting starvation in India. India was beginning to starve.
Yeah, India just had a deficit of nutrition kind of across the whole country. Only a small percentage of the people would have been, by Western standards, considered well-fed. So this idea that there was, that these global famines were A, inevitable, and B, we needed to, as the sheriffs, the gatekeepers, but also the producers of grain, although, you know, there were other nations also producing grain.
Yeah.
But this was maybe going to be a situation where the Cold War ended as a result of both the Russians and, or the Soviets and the West being able to produce enough food and cooperating to rescue the global South, however well we could.
This is the hopeful treatise of the book, is that right?
Not really. There is no hopeful treatise of the book. Famine 1975 is a real drag. But Famine 1975...
Will I understand it if I haven't read Famine 1974? Famine number one through 1974?
This is Famine 1975! Exclamation point, Electric Boogaloo. But in 1968, one short year later, a Stanford professor by the name of Paul Ehrlich and his wife Anne, who was a biologist, had been kind of giving speeches, giving lectures, and you know, if you can imagine a Stanford professor in 1968 and the environment of exciting social change and unrest that was happening there during this period, he was giving lectures to the effect of and derived a lot from Fairfield Osborne and William Vogt's books and this contemporary thinking. That there was a kind of population bomb that was about to explode. And all of this was imminent.
This is just the Malthusian idea that the exponential growth is...
Yeah, we have achieved...
We're seeing the doubling.
The Malthusian catastrophe. And so they published their book, The Population Bomb, in 68, and in the introduction, they said the following. The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, hundreds of millions of people will starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate. And then they suggested that the solution was to bring the world population under control. This is all that can be done. To reduce growth to zero, or potentially negative growth. And to...
How problematic are the remedies suggested?
Well, this is exactly right. In order to avert this catastrophe, and I mean, hundreds of millions are going to die no matter what you do, but in order to avert increasing catastrophe... That human numbers need to be regulated. Food production, of course, needs to be increased. But the U.S. must take the lead. And here were some of their suggestions. Temporary sterilance in the water supply. A tax penalty for people that had more than one child. This is sort of the Chinese model.
Sterilizing in the water.
In the water. So if you wanted to,
if
you were approved to have kids, you could either. You could go up into the mountains,
get a Brita,
or you could appeal to the government and they would give you clean water.
But the default position of society is nobody's having families.
Yeah, sterilization medicine in the water, and just like fluoride in the water.
Which I'm also worried about.
There was also, he also proposed a luxury tax on children's supplies.
That's how you'll do it.
Yeah.
If Crayola crayons cost $86 a box,
exactly.
Nobody will have children.
Diapers, cribs, they're all $1,000 each, and that will keep people from having
That's the Chris Rock remedy.
And then incentives for men to get vasectomies. The idea being... That's a better way to...
I feel like getting a vasectomy should be its own reward, you know?
Knowing a few people who have had it, it doesn't seem like it. It seems like a drag at every level. And then they were absolutely in this book, The Population Bomb, which went on to sell 2 million copies and was a massive success and a massive influencer of the culture. Ehrlich was a guest on Johnny Carson. They became sort of celebrities and talking heads. This pervaded the culture of the mid-1970s.
It was kind of the culture I was born in.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, I remember, if you were tuned into maybe conservative culture at that time, you would probably see, religious movements against it, evangelicals warning that this was all anti-family. I remember there was, I didn't grow up in that bubble, but, growing up in Mormon culture of the 1970s and 80s, the bad guys were often, you'd expect to see, feminists or pro-choice activists among the cultural villains, but it was also zero population folks.
Yeah.
It was post-Ehrlichians who were the threat to the family because they were literally the threat to the family.
Yeah, they sure were.
They were trying to sterilize parents.
Well, and growing up in the liberal ivory towers that I did, a lot of kids my own age in high school very proudly proclaimed that they would never have children. And of course, you still hear that all the time from young people who are like, well, I don't want to bring a child into this world.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still or again, but yes.
Yeah. I remember my high school girlfriend saying in response to somebody, well, I'm going to have 2 kids and there's nothing you can do about it. And me feeling like, wow, that's quite a recidivist position.
Well, as her boyfriend, it certainly puts you in the, in a position of responsibility.
Well, at that point in time, I didn't know that if you kissed a girl that might lead to something else. And and that might be troubling. I was like, well, yeah, babies, sure. When the stork comes, what can you say? You can't turn it away. A lot of the people that felt like this was anti-family and in that sense, immoral, they were joined by people that saw the potential here and saw, written in capital letters, the social engineering implications. And this was during an era, as we've discussed many times, where social engineering, although eugenics had been discredited, social engineering was on top of everybody's lists. We were going to make a utopia in this country come hell or high water.
But yeah, I mean, I guess all the great society stuff is, right. It's nudgy social engineering.
For sure.
This can still be done with smart policy, and I guess I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, we're going to change the way cities work. We're going to change the way schools work. We're going to change the way the economy works. And all of those things are going to bring about a more equitable, freer, and more prosperous society. And that prosperity is not going to result in a Malthusian catastrophe where we just keep having more and more children, because we're going to control that too. And so the Freedom's Just Another Word for Nothing Left to Lose folks saw this as a potential set of policies that would result in tremendous government overreach. Because if you're managing who does and doesn't have kids, who's managing that exactly?
This is the death panels argument from the Obama era.
That's right. And the Ehrlichs did not back away.
They were ready to have the big arguments, huh?
They were, and they proposed a Department of Population and Environment with the power to, in their words, take whatever steps were necessary to establish a reasonable population size in the U.S. and put an end to the deterioration of the environment.
I feel like if you're a scientist like Paul Ehrlich, he's a social scientist, and in particular, if you're a Jewish social scientist, biologist, I believe he is, maybe you want to stand a little bit back from the state can take any means necessary to control population growth.
Yeah, the feeling, the alarmism at this point had reached its own kind of had its own unstoppable momentum.
Yeah.
And the idea that they were all confronting, and this is what, you know, what intellectuals love to do, is to say, listen, because this is inevitable, only we can see it, and we need to confront the hard truths. Because if one person needs to get pushed out of the airlock, as hard as that is, we need to
do it now.
We need to draw that short
before
straw
before the orbit decays.
That's right. And like what seems to us now incredible, one of the suggestions was that because in much of the world, people will continue to have babies until they get a son.
Mm-hmm.
And so many families will have four girls in the hopes that they'll have a male child. The Ehrlich suggested or proposed that
I think I see where this is going.
Yeah, that prenatal sex discernment be used to abort girl fetuses. And then the families, when they got a boy, would stop having babies. Because that's what they really wanted.
And he's not concerned about the gender imbalances that would result in this country because that would dampen population growth further.
That's right. Because, yeah, right.
Because there will be...
No girls.
No, not enough.
Not enough.
No girls allowed.
There was, as you can imagine, a lot of pushback from not just the usual suspects of Mormons and
their traditional allies,
utilitarians.
The utilitarians.
Yeah. But from, you know, anybody following along, like you say, who isn't prepared to lean heavily into eugenics and sex discernment. But even as this was the topic of conversation throughout the West, and even as there were, as we recall, those famines in the early 80s we've discussed before in Ethiopia that produced We Are the World, et cetera.
But it had even worse effects. Like, they did produce We Are the World, but they were also bad in Africa.
Yeah, that's right.
Hard to believe We Are the World was not the worst outcome of the Ethiopian
and
famine.
I think that's maybe still debatable. The many people who died.
It's a tie.
And then We Are the World.
Do they know it's Christmas is not bad?
It's bad.
Oh, come on.
It's bad. They do know it's Christmas, and many of them aren't Christians, and so it being Christmas doesn't matter to them.
Do they know it's solstice after all?
Yeah, I'm sure they do. They can see the stars as well as anyone. But coincidentally, not in response at all to the publication of the book Our Plundered Planet or The Population Bomb, in 1968, we reached the peak of population growth.
So he was writing this at the exact moment that things were about to get better and he didn't know.
Population was growing at a rate of 2% a year in 1968. By 2018, 50 years later, it was 1%. And that decline was steady. From 68 to 2018, it was a constant decline in the rate of population
right.
growth.
The population is not decreasing, but right. the growth is slowing down.
No, the population has increased astonishingly. In 68, it was 3.5 billion. By 81, it was 4.5.
I always think that we're still in a 4 billion person world, because that was kind of the benchmark when I was a kid.
When you were reading Guinness Book of World Records.
And now it's twice that, and I'm like, what?
It was as recently as 1992, it was 5.5 billion. In 2004, it was 6.5 billion. Now we're getting to the same age as some of the mustard in my refrigerator. In 2016...
Half of Indonesia is now younger than your mustard.
2016, it was 7.5 billion, and now it is 8.2 billion. So it is a crazy graph.
Yeah, and a reminder to clean your fridge. Hey, John, Pakistan says clean your fridge.
I know, and every time I see an email from Pakistan, I delete it immediately. And more than that, the global death rate has declined over that same period from 13 out of 1,000 people to 7.5 out of 1,000 people.
So we didn't do it by killing more humans?
No. What happened?
Not even aborting the girls.
The population is doubled, and
we can't have it all.
Rather than a famine, during that same period, the global calories per person have increased 24%.
And I think savvy omnibus listeners and other historians probably know what happened.
Why don't you sketch it out for us?
Advances in rice hybridization, right?
That's right. That's right. In it's what's called the Green Revolution. Now, there was a lot of criticism of Ehrlich at the time for a variety of reasons.
You could have named the show after Norman Borlaug. You could have had the hero instead of the villain.
That's right. I could have, but that isn't how we're going to do it.
You're Gen X.
The population bomb is what it's called.
You're cranky.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Some of the original arguments against Malthusianism that happened in the 60s in response to this population bomb conversation was that statistics actually showed that population growth actually happens. People have more babies in response to a high mortality rate.
Replacement.
And in fact, as income grows and standard of living grows, people have fewer children.
Is this is this something you can see with birds? No, right? It feels like this is more of a sentient species problem, you know, when things are going great for birds, they just make more birds.
Yeah, right. Well, and the thing is that animals that are predation animals do grow in these cycles, and then their predators grow in response.
Right.
And then there are fewer prey animals, and then the predator population suffers. I mean, there is a symbiosis.
And it's not a homeostasis. It's a swinging pendulum, right? You know, it's a series of shifting populations.
So in that sense, it's one of the ways in which human beings are, you know, somewhat separate from the cycle of prey and predator, although, you know, we're still susceptible to the cycle of disease and also the weather affects us, earthquakes.
I remember this is only tangentially related, but as late as the early 2000s, I remember my boss at work, I guess a Mormon guy, so a result of the product of the same culture as me, just shaking his head sadly at the part in The Matrix where it implies that humans are like caterpillars on a leaf eating too ravenously. And he was just, oh, did you see the liberal messaging in The Matrix? So disappointed that even The Matrix had let him down.
Even The Matrix.
And this is a guy who had grown up, with the zero population threat. You know?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, as QAnon will tell us, The Matrix is a documentary.
That's true. And my boss knew it first.
But the Green Revolution can actually kind of be traced back to the Vice President of the United States, Henry Wallace, during the
FDR vice president,
third FDR term. Wallace had been the Secretary of Agriculture, And he went on a tour of Mexico in this era and was astonished to see that in Mexico, they were their agriculture was producing not enough corn to feed the population of Mexico. And their agricultural practices were insufficient and also kind of archaic. And Wallace was a student of new science in agriculture. And he went to the Rockefeller Foundation and said, will you fund the development of new corn hybrids that can grow more effectively in Mexico? And also will find the government funds new loans to support irrigation and mechanization in Mexican agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And through this kind of process, he did find, and you mentioned him already, the agronomist Norman Borlaug. And Norman was a food scientist and went after this problem. And 8 years later, a short 8 years after this program was initiated, Mexico had not only achieved food independence, but then over the course of, in 1943, they had to import half. So it wasn't just corn. In 43, they had to import half of the wheat that they consumed.
Yeah, I guess I thought the India revolution was being rice, but it's mostly wheat-based at first.
That's right.
Huh.
By 56, they imported no wheat, and by 64, they were exporting wheat. Over the course of 20 years...
By 1970, they were so sick of wheat, they were dumping it in the ocean.
They were shooting wheat into the sky, and then the birds would eat it out of the sky, and then they would shoot the birds.
Half of Mexico was gluten intolerant because of too much wheat.
In the course of 20 years, they increased corn production by 3 and wheat production by 5. And as a result of it, Borlaug won the Nobel Prize.
He's also in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Really?
Although I'm trying to find out now if it's because of his distinguished wrestling career or if it's just because he was a distinguished guy who was also a wrestler. And I don't know if I'll ever know the answer to this. But yeah, probably maybe the only person in the National Wrestling Hall of Fame with a Nobel Prize. I don't think Macho Man has a Nobel Prize.
Not yet.
Not yet.
He's not dead.
He is
dead. Oh, wait, he is dead. Oh, it's too late.
Yes.
Well, it's not too late. You know, Nobel Prize in literature often goes to a dead person.
No, sadly, it does
not. Oh, that's too bad that I didn't know that.
You cannot posthumously get a Nobel Prize.
Is that right?
Let's not edit that out. Let's have the moment where everyone learns.
What about Bob Dylan? Isn't he? Oh, wait, he's still alive, too.
He's still alive. I remember this because they didn't give a peace prize in, I think, 48, whatever year Gandhi died, because, you know, it's like leaving an empty chair for Elijah.
Yeah.
Like Gandhi, it would have been Gandhi, but we can't give it to a dead guy.
And so we put it on the mantle.
No peace this year.
And we put a candle in it.
They just took $1 million and they just spent it on candy.
But the excitement of the success of these early experiments in the Green Revolution led to what we think of as the tremendous implementation of science in agriculture, both in the increase in chemical fertilizing and also hybrid crops that are less vulnerable to insects, that are stronger against all weather and all comers and bad soil, and also, you know, the improvement of soil, irrigation, the spread of, well, and in a way, global capitalism, increased production around the world.
You feed more people without changing any of the other inputs.
In the Philippines, they developed IR-8 rice, which is this famous rice that you're referring to in India.
IR-8 rice also. IR-8 rice for dinner.
Yeah, much rice, woof.
IR, much rice.
IR, hate Russia. Anyway, the Philippines greatly expanded their production of rice, ending famine there briefly, although political corruption then came into the food supply.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's
if you can afford that much rice, Imelda Marcos can afford even more shoes.
That's right. There became like food insecurity again just because the food was being diverted.
To shoe shopping.
But in India in particular, a tremendous success story. Undernourishment fell by half. By 2010, malnourishment in India. And the thing is, there are still hundreds of millions of people that are like food unstable, but relative to the population of the earth, the level of nutrition, the level of well-being, the disease is declined.
Despite the number of people being probably twice what Ehrlich thought was starting to be a problem. Yeah. And Ehrlich's still alive, right?
Well, Ehrlich is still alive, and Ehrlich has not recanted.
He's like, yeah, you can put it off with tech.
Interestingly, in China, they pursued a green revolution completely separate from all of the methods being used in the West. And in China, a man by the name of Huan Longping.
Probably not Huan, right?
Y-U-A-N.
Oh, like Yuan.
Huan Yuan.
I think it'd be funny if his name was Huan.
Huan Yuan.
He's from the southern part of China.
He traveled through China and interviewed all the local sort of small-scale farmers and developed a hybridization of different hardy rice within, a sort of Chinese agricultural sector, and produced a very resilient and non-GMO rice. And now China is the world's largest exporter of rice.
So kind of parallel techniques, but different tech. No shared tech.
Again, somewhat suggesting that the Green Revolution and the alarmism of the population bomb, it didn't just have one coincidental, accidental solution.
Luckily, this one wheat hybrid existed.
Exactly. Luckily, thank God for Borlaug.
It suggests a broader thing that when civilization-threatening stuff looms, that in general, science and progress can mobilize, which would be nice to believe.
Unfortunately, as you say, Ehrlich has not recounted his many sort of sweeping claims in the population bomb. And over the course of sort of a lot of interviews in the intervening 50 years, has gradually shifted his story to say, well, it was always a metaphor, and actually it is true despite all the short-term evidence that it wasn't. The long-term evidence still trends toward this. And then he started to connect it to climate change as an inevitability, not of a lack of ability to grow the food, but that the climate will change and the food will be ungrowable, which is an argument you hear often in the climate change.
But it's certainly not his original argument.
Not at all.
It's like, well, we solved one problem with an unforeseen stroke of good luck, but now there's another unforeseen thing that I didn't know about, but somehow makes my 66 premise valid.
And then he connects it now more and more to overconsumption and inequality. And in some ways, you can just kind of go down and see what the buzzwords are now, and he's applying his population bomb theory to it.
Yeah, it's the other way around. Good thing this thing is happening to fit my prior belief.
What's interesting is there have been many famine since 1968.
Are you saying the plural of famine is famine?
That's what I'm doing.
Like salmon?
I think so. There have been many famines.
There have been many schools of famine.
Multiple famine since 1968. But in almost every, if not every instance, the famine is a result of corruption.
Yeah.
And
it's true in Ethiopia, right?
Yeah.
There was enough food, it just never got to the hungry people.
That's right. And that's true globally. I mean, in many of these cases, these countries that used to be, I mean, India now is a food exporter.
Wow.
And so there's food.
And it's delicious. Like
delicious.
Like India and Mexico food. Exporting food is amazing.
That's because incredible food.
Unlike American food, it's so good.
Yeah, if it weren't for Mexican food, half of America would be starving. And if it weren't for Indian food, half of England would be starving.
Europe would be starving, yeah. Exactly.
So all of this, I think, is cautionary only in the sense that although we here do believe that climate change is real and
a very serious threat.
A great threat. What you can never know is what happens next. And none of the things that defused the population bomb, it wasn't one thing. It was...
And it certainly wasn't the dire, gloomy work. It wasn't the everybody just has to suffer now and we need to start aborting girls.
And it wasn't just a technology. It was also a realization that some of the fundamental ideas that drove... the theory were unfounded or ill-founded. It wasn't true that people had more babies when they were wealthy was maybe the first Malthusian mistake. And so now we don't talk about overpopulation, even though, as you were saying, in our childhoods, it was.
If you had told us there would be 8 billion people by the time you were middle aged, we think we would be living on.
We'd be having one bean a day.
The hell planet from Soylent Green.
And other than nuclear catastrophe, it seemed to be the inevitable way the world would end.
And that concludes The Population Bomb, entry 966.GE2803, certificate number 2037, in the omnibus. Futurelings, we don't know which of the various threats to our well-being will, in fact, end the human race, or whether it's 100,000 years away.
It's pop music.
You think it's going to be pop music?
It's Do They Know It's Christmas? It will become sentient.
I think that, I mean, that song's 40 years old. It's got to be.
I mean, how old is Baby Yoda?
Baby Yoda is a baby, but he's like 100, is that right?
Yeah, something like that. And he's only just now. Able to like talk and do stuff.
I feel like when I'm 100, I will also be being carried around by a larger man. Like I think that's also my future.
In a like a hovering bastic.
I hope so.
I see that. I could see that.
Like, and I hope he'll let me fly his transit sometimes, but probably not.
Yeah, little wrinkled Ken in a bastic who's reaching out to grab the control knob.
It'll just be my employee carrying me around, trying to get me to not touch things.
Going to be me. I'll be long dead.
I mean, we think of him as a baby, but the more I think about it, we should think of Baby Yoda as an old man. A larger guy is carrying him around, trying to keep him from touching things, which is what we do to the elderly.
Yeah, that's right.
Sit over here.
Grandfather Ken.
Don't touch the remote.
Nope.
You'll break it. Leave that alone. It's not dinner yet. But at some point... every system ends. Social media is over. We were at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. We're probably not now.
Isn't that nice? I can breathe a sigh of relief.
I think I'm going to be on Instagram, but...
it's fun. The idea of you being on Instagram. Instagram's not fun. It's awful, but you being
You think
on
it might
Instagram,
get better if I show up?
I mean, it's going to be...
What Ehrlich couldn't predict. Something awesome like me being on Instagram.
What's great is that I'm going to leave snarky comments on your posts and then, like snorks who just love Jeopardy will be like, why are you so mean?
It just means the Jeopardy PR people running the account will have to delete them or whatever you can do on Instagram. Exactly.
the teenage interns that you hire.
Email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with your technical ideas that will save the world. If you have carbon capture working in your basement, if you're going to be the Norman Borlaug of climate change, we want to know. You can send physical items to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98133 or 55. We now know that 33 is a little better than 55.
Can be.
44, slower than all of them and makes the mailman angry. Let's see, what if
you don't want an angry mailman?
No, or letter carrier of any gender.
That's right.
Or none at all. Non-binary or prefers not to respond letter carriers also don't make them mad. Our friend Peter that sent us a copy of his cryptic book, The Malphabet.
I remember.
Like, I'll just open it up and I'll tell you, John. Horse Graveyard. That's kind of a bummer. Let me open it up again.
Graveyard.
Serifed Flamboyance. That's a little better. Administrative Oubliette. Ooh, I want to be in an administrative oubliette. He has a new edition of his book. He sent us his paperback. And I guess because we liked it on the show, it now has my cover blurb on it.
Hey! A blurb from Omnibus? Is that the first time an Omnibus quote has been used as a blurb?
I think so. And he was kind of, he actually contacted me and said, you guys said something nice about my book on the show. Is it okay if I use it to blurb the book? And I was like, sure, I did like the book. I actually liked the book.
That's pretty cool.
Let's see, wait, which one is signed to you? This one.
Oh, I was waiting for you to say, oh, they're both signed to me.
That's crazy.
Ken and Ken's kids.
And let me see. Thank you so much, Peter. Again, the book is called The Malphabet. If you are interested in reading the one idea per page book that Peter wrote when he was coming out of a coma, interestingly.
Yeah. Do you think it's Malthusian when he says Malphabet?
Malthusian. This book is very Malthusian.
Or is it Ralph Malph? Is that who he's referring to?
It's named for Ralph Malph. The Ralph Malphabet is all the letters you need to spell Ralph Malph. That's it.
Yeah.
So it has A, H, L, M, P, and R.
I said the
Malphabet is very short.
I said to my kid the other day, she said something, I don't remember what it was, and I said, sit on it, Potsy. And she didn't know what that meant. And I don't think I had said sit on it, Potsy, in 20 years.
And she didn't know? That's so weird.
I know, weird.
Were you shocked that she didn't understand that reference?
Sit on it, Potsy. Well, yeah, I was. And then I told her to sit on it.
Did you sit her down and have her watch some Three's Company Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley?
No, unfortunately, she's just now grown out of the age where I can sit her down and have her watch anything. It's too late now.
It's actually gotten to the point where I don't recommend things I like because the kids will only like them if they discover them on their own.
Right.
If I say, you know what you should see, they will not see, read, or hear it.
Yes.
And, of course, the most important thing you can do to support Omnibus is not to send us a copy of your self-published book, although we dig that when that happens. But a little more accessible would be to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and show your hope for the future by supporting the Omnibus going forward. The show is actually in the black for a change because of those who support the show. They can now listen to it early. They get the show 48 hours early without any ads. Now, if you miss the ads for underwear with stainless steel fibers in them, don't worry. You can go back and listen to it after.
Yes, you may.
But it just means you have the choice. You have the choice to have the underwear-free show if you want to. So patreon.com/omnibusproject will let you become a supporter at the level that makes you feel good about yourself. That's what you're buying. You're buying a clean conscience. Omnibus is already there. You're buying a clean conscience and bonus episodes. That's
yes.
What you're buying.
You know, I didn't mention in the show that Ehrlich had in his own time, almost immediately, a nemesis and critic by the name of Barry Commoner, who wrote a book called The Closing Circle in 71 that just took him to task. And they did these hilarious like public debates where apparently Ehrlich was a humorless and bitter shouter and Commoner was like a hilarious, like low-key like tire kicker. And I really wish that I could watch whatever Dick Cavett show that appeared on.
I was checking to see if Ehrlich had kids. Like, did he put his, you know, his money where
did he sterilize himself?
Yeah, did he put his money where his genitals were? And in fact, he did. He had one daughter in the 50s and then had a vasectomy. Possibly in the same hospital visit?
Well, what do you know?
While your wife's in the birthing ward, you can be up in I don't know who gives vasectomies.
Doctors.
Proctologists?
I don't know.
Probably not.
There's probably a whole vasectomy doctor sphere. What do you think putting your money where your mouth is looks like for young, environmental catastrophe Malthusians?
I guess moving to Siberia?
I mean, because there are so many things that are self-congratulatory, like electric cars and living off the grid and all these things, but that actually are kind of worse for the environment. Electric cars don't help a damn thing.
Not that much.
And yeah, all the kind of ones where it's like, well, I don't eat beef anymore. It's like, that wasn't the problem either. I wonder if there's...
It doesn't hurt.
Well, I mean, I guess. I mean, it's like dropping the bucket land.
No. It makes you sad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. There are a lot of people that don't like the beefs. Although famine is now a plural. Beefs is the way we refer to
not beeves?
Multiple cow. Beeves.
Beeves?
I want to say that I don't, you know, that I hope, Ken, that I don't feel like I'm grinding on an agenda here. Does it feel like that to you? I don't want any of our listeners to be like, oh, here he comes again with his...
The outro's too late. The outro's too late. No one's listening to this.
No, lots of people do. Lots of people think that this is our funniest work.
But not this time.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, you're not some kind of the young people. You're definitely not a climate change is fake crank. You may be a the young people piss me off crank, but everyone turns into that.
Well, but they don't piss me off. I just want it to be clear that people my age do have something to offer the world, which is a little bit of perspective. But that's not a very popular stance, is it? That's just like, ugh, modern hip-hop isn't as good as 80s hip-hop.
Well, yeah, you can always think about what you thought of elderly people in your childhood telling you that you needed to listen to them more.
Well, but I did listen to them more. That's why I...
Is that true?
Well, I think so. I mean, my dad and his generation, you know, who were like, we made the... we fought the Germans. You know, I was like, tell me more. I didn't say, there aren't even any Germans anymore. You killed them all.
So you're kind of an honorary boomer.
No, the boomers didn't listen to those guys. I'm saying I was the honorary only greatest, one that did.
Honorary greatest generation.
Yeah, it's what Gen X did. They sat at the feet of their grandfathers as they said, I don't remember what I did on D-Day, but there was one German. I looked into his eyes. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. Maybe it survives forever. Maybe you're just listening to this show because it's one of the greatest shows of all time, and you're living in a peaceful utopian community.
But then this is the population bomb of our time.
What is?
That the show is premised on the idea that the collapse is coming.
You're absolutely right. People listen to this as a comedy show. And they're like, the funniest thing about that show is the idea that the world is ending.
If we had been Paul Ehrlich, like one kid and then a vasectomy the next day, we should have put out one episode and then immediately had a podcast vasectomy and deleted our channel.
It's like if this was a Greek podcast and they were like, no one's ever heard of the Greeks.
Yes.
Nothing's based on Greek civilization.
Would it be like that?
I don't know.
I'll take your word for it.
I don't know. I mean, we keep talking to octopus and what do they have to say about it?
Well, they don't like the Greeks. Greeks keep eating them.
That's right. They do.
Octopus hate the Greeks. And it's not vice versa.
You didn't hear it here
Greeks
first.
Love octopus, and it is not mutual.
We hope and pray that the octopus survive and that the catastrophe we fear otherwise may not come, although we're on the fence about whether it happens to the Greeks or not.
We are convinced that technology will allow both Greeks and octopus to survive, even though current graphs are a little bit dire.
If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word or may be worshipped in a temple. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and calamari and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.